So, I did want to go back to the Tareb Tulku text and move forward with that a little bit. And because, as I said, there are some folks who aren't here, aren't well, and I promise to continue moving forward with this. So, pardon me, I'll just do that. The place where I wanted to begin. So the place where I wanted to begin with this was with the fourth and the fifth paragraphs, which is why I actually named the paragraphs. And what I'll do, since I'm audio recording this, I'll just read it. I'll read them so you don't have to be concerned about that either. So this ordinary state of mind that we were talking about, that's sort of like the thing that we often want to get out of, expand out of in the earlier part of the conversation, he calls that coarse rational consciousness. And we'll come back to that and where that comes from. So he says, when coarse rational consciousness is dominant, the sense impressions received from a given object trigger a process of perception that is strongly influenced by the individual's existing worldview. So that's the key thing. The result of this process is a mental image that is both distorted and remote from the object in focus, and which acts to reinforce the worldview by conforming to it. And in the fifth paragraph, he goes on, and he says, the formation of mental images involves several steps. So the reason I wanted to start there is that mental image, that's sort of like the Tibetan way of talking about a representation that we have of something, again, along the lines of what we were chatting about a little bit earlier. He even uses the example, which he gets out of amazingly general semantics, of the map and the territory. And the mental image is like the map that references the territory that's out there. And he goes on to say that in the modern West, anyway, and he was living in, I think, Copenhagen when he was writing all this. He was a Tibetan monk who, for whatever reason, I don't know why, he ended up in Copenhagen teaching. And so that's actually one of the reasons his translation is a little bit spotty in some ways. It's from Tibetan to Danish to English, so you can imagine that there were little rough spots along the way in terms of style and syntax and whatnot. But the general idea that the Tibetans have is that, actually Buddhists in general, but the Tibetans have articulated it particularly well, the idea that they have is that we live in a mental space in which we understand everything and we negotiate the mental space of images. Now, images doesn't literally mean only images. The term is actually broader than that. It's image, sound, thought, feeling, whatnot. The technical term actually is better translated as generic image into English. But it's like a mental representation would be a good alternative to the word image. So what he's saying, and what the Buddhists are saying generally, is that all of us live in an experiential space that's mostly mental images. And we live or mental representations, and we live in a space that's chock full of mental representations of an external reality. And like many Western philosophers, the Buddhists say, actually the external reality is something we never encounter in and of itself, because everything comes to us through our sense organs and is then compiled into this representation. But he does say that modern Western peoples, although I would at this point say modern peoples generally, because I'm sure this is true of people in Beijing and Singapore and Delhi and every place else that's been highly Westernized in terms of a sense of a kind of capitalistic, industrial kind of mentality, we live in this space of mental representation, but we don't live so much even with our direct sense experience, let alone the reality that's outside of what our senses create. In fact, we can't experience what's outside of what our senses create. So what he's talking about then in the first second and third paragraphs is how that process works. So I wanted to back it down to that, which is, for modern people, I think, pretty straightforward, but for ancient people, it was a little bit of a revelation, because they didn't know that they didn't live in reality. They thought that what they experienced was what was. They didn't know that what they experienced was a mental representation that was constructed in some way. Well, we've all been to, you know, we've all taken biology class in high school and probably college and whatnot. You kind of know how it works. That, for example, with the eyes, there's light falls on the retina, and then there's this process that goes on where the light that's falling on the retina is ultimately converted to an image of something that's going on. But in the process of creation of that image, a number of things happen. And we know from our Western, modern Western educational tradition that that representation is also built in relationship to tactile experience and auditory experience, and that whole package becomes a representation. And sometimes we think about the fact, emphasized by the Buddhists, that the way the representation is developed also is impacted by language and impacted by cultural values and impacted by desires and aversions. So in fact, the way the Buddhists look at it, they sort of look at the sequence where they say, you know, the sensory experience, the perception, the creation of a perception, before you actually even create the perception, and you have this sort of raw sensory experience going on, the first thing that happens is, based upon your past experience, you feel an attraction or an aversion to something. So he talks about this in great detail. Where does the attraction or the aversion come from? He says, based upon the self-image, you feel that something is in accord with your self-image, and then you like it. Or something is not in accord with your self-image, and then you don't like it. I mean, as part of it, I think that he's saying that for a specific Western audience. I think it's a little bit broader than that. That in general, everything that comes to you, you either are attracted to for whatever reason, or repelled by for whatever reason. And I would just say it's broader than that. It could be, well, I'll use an example for myself. I noticed that when I was a teenager, there were certain things that I found attractive and other things I found unattractive. Like, I'd drive downtown with my dad during the summer. I had a job downtown with him, his factory where he was at. And I found downtown Los Angeles ugly. Well, he probably found downtown Los Angeles ugly too, and I probably found it ugly because he found it ugly, which would be the reason why he spent 45 minutes driving from this lovely suburb to downtown Los Angeles and wasting huge amounts of his time and resources in the process of doing that, because he didn't want to live any place near downtown because it was not attractive to him. So I picked up that it wasn't attractive, and I found it unattractive. And then there are other things that I find attractive or unattractive that I would be attracted to or repelled by. And if I really thought about this over my life, I could see how many of those things were actually my parents' attractions or repulsions. A lot of them didn't have anything to do with what I actually felt. And if I kind of looked at what I actually felt, I'd say, well, maybe they don't find that repulsive, or maybe they don't find that attractive, you know. But I had to look at it first to figure that out. So that process goes on right off the bat, and then we construct this representation, and then also built into the representation is language. So here's another example that I have in the life, which is that, you know, I hold up my hand here, and I have, you know, five fingers and the palm and my forearm and whatnot. And what do I call that? I call that my arm. And if I only talk about the space above my wrist, I call that my hand. But in Tibetan, you can't make that distinction. Tibetans can only talk about the space between the elbow and the fingertips. They have no way to, they don't distinguish in the same way that we do. And so when they talk about a hand, it includes the forearm. And actually, if you look at it physiologically, it's correct, because everything that controls the fingers and whatnot, all those tendons and stuff, they move up the forearm. You know, this distinction here is somewhat artificial. I mean, they see it. It's not like they don't see it. They know the distinction is there, but their language doesn't emphasize it the way ours does. So so then language, you know, comes into this process also of creating this mental representation. So then the problem is that we live in a world of mental representation, most of which is unexamined. And because it's unexamined, we don't know what it is and what it's doing. It runs us. So we're not free. We're not free in our own mental space, let alone being free within the literal space that we live. So can we get free in the literal space in which we live? Well, in a sense, no. Because the fact is that the literal space in which we live is hot or is cold, it's dry or it's wet, and we're only going to be in it for a certain space of time. And during that space of time, we're going to get old and crotchety, and the population is going to expand, and you know this is going to happen, and that's going to happen. And there are many things going on there that we have no control over, even if we wanted to have control over them, we couldn't. You know, we could work hard, and we could get really rich, and we could live in a house with air conditioning and heat, and we wouldn't have to worry about heat and cold. But no matter how much money we have, our bodies are going to get old and creaky, and that's just the way it is. You know, so there are physical things we can't do anything about. On the other hand, there are things that we can do something about in the mental space. And the first step of doing something about the mental space we live in is to understand the mental space that we live in. So what he's talking about here in this text is basically understanding how that mental space is created and how it works, so you can watch the way it works, and then you can have a different kind of relationship with it. So now, of course, this isn't instantaneous. Another example. Over the years, I found that I was smoking more and more cigarettes. You drank a lot of coffee. Well, there's a period of time I was smoking more and more cigarettes. Now, for me, smoking a lot of cigarettes got to be 6 cigarettes in a day. I mean, I didn't have like a humongously impossible, you know, problem with tobacco, but I did have an addiction to it because I would have those 6 cigarettes a day, and it was a very hard habit to get out of. I joke that I quit smoking frequently. It was no trouble at all. I quit smoking about 30 or 40 times until I finally did. And the way that I stopped smoking was I thought, every time I want a cigarette, there's a choice point. I can do will or I won't at that point. And I can choose not to. And, you know, maybe an hour later I'm going to end up choosing to have a cigarette. But the more frequently I decided not to, the stronger that habit became. And the less frequently I decided to do it, the weaker that habit became, until over time, the weight of things shifted. But it was a moment-by-moment ongoing process of making decisions about noticing what my experience was and why this is happening, and then mobilizing the ability to not have the cigarette. You know, and then circumstances would change, and there'd be some horrible thing going on at work, and I'd get totally stressed out, and I'd have to go outside the office and smoke a cigarette just to, you know, whatever. In my mind, I had to do it anyway. But I couldn't resist that. And then in time, I could resist that. So, you know, the reason I use the example is that if you get to the place through Buddhist meditation and philosophy of seeing how the process works, that doesn't necessarily solve the problem, right? But it gives you the ability to see what the issue is, so you can begin to work on the problem versus being in a situation where you don't even know what's going on, and then working on a problem is kind of hopeless. Now, the kind of meditation that we've been doing, as odd as it may have seemed at various times, is a practice of creating mental images that have a different effect. So that's the whole point. That the meditation with this kind of mental imagery is like the antidote to the mental spaces that we usually find ourselves in. Now, we can say, well, I don't see how that's the antidote. You know, like, how is Vajrasattva an antidote to nicotine addiction? I mean, here's this white figure with a consort, radiating luminous light, you know, sitting in a cross-legged position. How is that an antidote to, you know, cigarettes and nicotine? I don't see how that's going to work at all. But the other thing that we know as modern people is that we have something called an unconscious mind. You talked about the archetypes, okay? We know we have an unconscious mind. What's really hard to accept about the unconscious mind is that it is. Now, Buddhists don't say we have an unconscious mind quite in the same way, but they do say that we have mental impressions and habits that we're just totally not aware of. So that's like having an unconscious mind, in a certain way, I guess. So the thing about having an unconscious that I find that's so difficult is that it really is unconscious. And it's really hard to accept. It's really hard to accept the idea that there are parts of me that are maybe even in control of large amount of what I'm doing, I don't know anything about. And every once in a while, you know, it'll creep out, and I'll look at it, and I'll say, wow, it's really there, and that'll be a big wake-up call. I'll do something incredibly stupid or nasty, and I'll say, where did that come from? That's not me. I don't do things like that. I don't say things like that. Well, there it was. I could hardly deny that it happened. And it's like, oh, okay, that stuff's going on. I mean, here's an example. 2 weeks ago, I was grumbling around at work, and I just really wanted a break. And in my mind, the solution to what I needed to help me work on a certain problem was go to the student union, have a nice toasted bagel with a whole lot of butter all over it. And that's exactly what I needed. And there's a lady that works in the grill there who laughs a lot. She laughs at everything. And I don't know exactly why she laughs at everything. But I went in there, and I said, I'd like to have a toasted bagel with butter, please. And she started laughing. She said, we don't have any. And I said, what? She said, well, we just have what they give me. And she was laughing. It's like her defense in this situation of being in the, you know, in the public relationship all the time. It's how she kind of like deals with it. And I looked at her, and what I heard myself say in the most unpleasant way was, I don't find anything amusing about that at all. And she just looked at me like, and then she kind of bent over like this, and like, oh, and she kind of wandered off. I'm going to go talk to the manager and see if I can get you a bagel. And I thought, oh my God, where did that come from? That was so mean-minded and nasty of me. Well, on the other hand, why was she laughing? But the thing is like, well, there's my unconscious. There it was, you know. So it's hard to accept that we have it. The other thing about not accepting that we have it is we really don't know what's going on down there. The Jungians might talk about archetypes, and the Freudians might talk about traumas from the past and so on and so forth. And what's true or not true, I don't know. I believe most of it. But that's not even the main point. The main point is we don't know what's down there. So the thing is, in this tradition, in this Buddhist tradition, we have these images that we're working with, which they say are antidotes to stuff. And we can look at that and say, I don't see how that's an antidote. Why am I doing that? That's pretty weird. Why do I imagine myself being blue? Most of us imagine ourselves being white, so that's not a problem. Not that white, like Vajrasattva white, but white. You know, we're Anglos, sort of. All right, I mean, we're Caucasians anyway. We're not all Anglos, right? We're Poles, and well, Irish are pretty Anglos. Not exactly, I don't know. Anyway, yeah, I realize I was getting myself in trouble there. You know, we're all Caucasians anyway. So, you know, imagining ourselves white, whatever. But imagining ourselves blue, now there's an interesting challenge. Okay. So, it's like, blue? I mean, there's no blue people around. Well, yeah, that's true, but we don't... there you go. Now, here's an interesting example, right. But see, we don't... What's in the subconscious? And what's in the subconscious, not just as sort of a negative thing, but as a positive thing, as an antidote. I mean, if we have a real hard time knowing about the negative stuff that's within us and accepting it, and identifying it, that's me. Think about the positive stuff that's buried down there. We would think, well, that's easy. Well, if it's positive and unconscious, what does that mean? I mean, now there's an interesting challenge. We think of, oh, all the negative stuff that's unconscious. No problem. Well, because we understand that the negative stuff is unconscious because we stuck it down there because our parents told us, you're not like that, you better not be like that. So we stuck it all down there because we didn't want to be like that because we wanted to please our parents. What about the positive stuff that's down there? That's more of a challenge. What about the positive stuff that's down there that is more than me as an individual? What about this positive stuff down there that doesn't come from my own life history? Now, that would be a real challenge. So when we're working with this imagery, it's easy to say, that doesn't make any sense. Why would I do that? Well, of course it doesn't make any sense. And why would you do it? Well, I know this is a bad word. We don't like this word, fate. This is a real bad word to use. Well, for most of us, you know, it's kind of like not a real good word. Okay. So here's how I'm going to use it. I mean, you know, for recovering Catholics, it's a bad word. Here's how I'm going to use it. Let's go back to the map and the territory. I want to get from, I've said this before, so it's going to be a little boring. I want to get from La Grande to Portland. Okay. And I've never driven farther than Pendleton. If I want to get to Portland, having a map is going to be a good thing. That's going to get me to Portland if I have a map, and they'll have a reading map. And it's a good map, and it's good representation. But how did that map come about? Somebody else went from Pendleton to Portland and created the map. Got it? Okay. So you know, the positive stuff that's down there in our subconscious mind, which we don't know about, and which the Buddhists say you can use these things to be an antidote to the negative stuff, either in the subconscious, unconscious, or in the conscious. Okay. Somebody else already went there, and they found that stuff, and they said, see, there it is. If you use it, it's going to be helpful to you. Now, you know, we don't have too much trouble going and picking up the Rand McNally Atlas that shows us how to get from Pendleton to Portland, because we have faith in it. It's not a big deal, right? But when somebody hands us an atlas that says, this is how you get from living in a constrained mental space to living in a more open mental space, we say, well, what? That doesn't look right to me. Or we have various challenges about it. So it's kind of like we don't have the same level of, quote, faith in what the religious teachings are from whatever tradition, in this case the Buddhist tradition. We don't have the same kind of faith in that as we have in the Rand McNally Atlas. So that's where the challenge is, and that's why I say there's this kind of word, faith. Now, the problem for all of us sitting around, well, the problem for some of us sitting around this table anyway, is that you don't have a good reason to believe what I'm saying. You don't have a good reason to accept on faith that this is going to be true. Because if you look at me, I've been practicing for a long time, and if you look at me, you say, he's a pretty ordinary looking guy, right? You know, what's special about him? Well, nothing, okay? But what I've had the good fortune to do is be around people who really were good at doing this practice, and they weren't ordinary. They were very non-ordinary, okay? So you spend time around people like the Dalai Lama. You spend time around some of the lamas that I've been around, and you kind of look at them, and you feel what it's like to be in their presence and watch what they do and how they talk to people and the way they answer the questions that they get, how they live their lives and this kind of stuff. And you say, whoa, there's something going on there. Meaning, so yeah, okay, what's going on there? Well, you ask them. They say, well, here was the text. Here's the cookbook, and it said, if you do this, you get to this place. And I'm not at that place, but I made a little bit of progress. And you look at them and say, oh, that's a little bit of progress? Okay, I'm going to give that a try. That looks good, because what's the alternative? I don't see an alternative. So I'm willing to say, I've met the people who got from my point of view, they got from Pendleton to Portland. They might say, nah, I didn't get any farther than the Dalles, or didn't get any farther than Boardman. I'm nothing special. And you know, say, okay, well, if that's what you want to say, then that's fine. But there's something unusual going on here. So I can say, I'm going to do this because I've seen some people who've done this and they went someplace that looks pretty good to me. And that's an advantage that I have. So I can say I have a certain kind of a faith, but it's rational faith. It's not just like, you know, somebody said that you should do this thing because somebody said you should do this thing. It's much more like, well, somebody said you should do this thing, and, well, look at that. Here are all these people who did this thing, and wow, I think I'm willing to make some effort to do this thing. So it's really beneficial to meet people like that. And until you do, it's kind of a little bit of a challenge. to say, well, okay, you know, I mean, there's David saying it works, and, you know, David can get real crotchety and he has an unconscious and yells at the people who don't give him bagels and stuff like that. And that's all true. Okay. But what it boils down to, you know, is, you know, Kay tells me I'm a nicer person than I was when she met me. So for over 25 years, something has happened. Maybe not very much, but something. And what would the alternative have been? The alternative would have been, I certainly would have gotten much more crotchety over the last 25 years if I hadn't done something to deal with my natural crotchetiness. So that's why the image is a long kind of around to that. So this, again, I'll finish up by going back to this text. So this paragraph 4 or 5 and the next few that follow on that are really worth attending to, because he talks about how, you know, this image creation thing works. And so that's the foundation for the other stuff. So where I'll go to the next time we meet is to talk about one other thing, which is there's a natural way in which the mental representations we create are distorted, no matter what we do, and that's another kind of problem. So there's the problem of the fact that we're confused about mental representations are not reality, for one thing. And then there's another thing about how we naturally create mental representations. I mean, one example is, I'm the only thing that matters in this world. Booth uses this example all the time. There are 5 of us sitting at this table, and every single one of us thinks we're the most important person on the planet. That's logically impossible, but we're all totally going to assent to that no matter what. So that's one issue. But there's another issue which has to do with the way the mind actually creates mental representations, which have fictional qualities to them, no matter what we try and do. And Buddhists talk about that a lot. They refer to it under the rubric of emptiness. So that's what I want to get to the next time we meet. Okay? And that should have answered a lot of the questions that you raised, Mary, I hope. Okay. So let's try some meditation after we take a little refreshment break. Yeah, that's a good one.
You were talking about...